Stars Over Surrey with Dave Gemmatis and John Extell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
Welcome, John. We're going to talk about the world of spaceflight and astronomy, your constellation of the month, what to look for in the night sky next month, and events at local astronomy societies. But first of all, what's happening in spaceflight and astronomy then, John?
Hello, Dave. I think we need to start with on a bit of a sad note, I'm afraid, but just remembering, you know, Britain's or the world's most famous scientist who's recently passed away, sadly, Stephen Hawking. But what a wonderful man, and how incredibly inspiring he is. How on earth did he manage to live so long after being given just 2 years to live at the age of 22? Now, we could talk all about his work, of course, but that's been covered in so many other arenas. So what I thought I'd do is just tell you about some of his quotes that I think sum up the man. Here's quite an inspirational one. Look up at the stars and not down at your feet. Try to make sense of what you see and wonder about what makes the universe exist. Be curious. I think that's a splendid line, particularly to youngsters. Another one, we are just an advanced breed of monkeys on a minor planet of a very average star, but we can understand the universe, and that makes us something very special. I think that one's quite profound. His humour comes out, though, in many of his quotes as well. How about this one? I can't disguise myself with a wig and dark glasses. The wheelchair gives me away. And another one. It was a recent event where he was being given an award and delivered, in fact, by Theresa May. And his quote was, I deal with tough mathematical questions every day, but please don't ask me to help with Brexit. Very, very nice, very topical, and just typical of the chap. A very sad loss. I must get round to trying to completely read the book, though, The Brief History of Time. It's been on my shelf for a while. I manage to start it every now and again and get into it and then put it back again. It's hard to absorb, but I think you've had a read of it, haven't you, Dave, yourself?
Oh, yeah, many years ago. I absolutely loved it. Great stuff.
Yeah, good, good, good. Okay, let's move on. And the thing I'd like to pick up on now is the International Space Station. And I haven't mentioned it for a while, but they've just had a crew rotation. First of all, the full crew is six, and they take it in turns to come back down. So three crew returned to Earth on 28th of February. That was two Americans and a Russian. And, of course, they use the Russian Soyuz craft, land down in Kazakhstan or that sort of area. And that left three people on board, one Russian, one American, and one from Japan. Now, the replacement crew to join those three has just docked on the 23rd of the month, and they're going to stay up there for a 159-day mission. And that's going to last, that'll probably take them up to September, with the three who were there already coming back down sometime in August. So the three that have gone up is one Russian and two Americans. So that gives us a total of three Americans on board, two Russians and one from Japan. Later on, after we've finished recording this broadcast, Dave, they'll be starting a spacewalk, one of a series that the new crew will be undertaking. Whilst we're thinking about the International Space Station, I'm sure it makes us think about SpaceX as well, because SpaceX is one of the companies that supplies International Space Station with reusable, its materials, its food, etc., that goes up, and new experiments using their Dragon capsule. And of course, we'll be taking crews up in their man rated Dragon 2, starting hopefully later this year, early next year. But they've just talked about what's been happening with their range of spacecraft. Now, the Falcon 9, which has been a workhorse spacecraft, launching so many craft, On the 5th of March, that launched a Spanish communication satellite and also a Department of Defense small satellite. That was the 50th such launch of a Falcon 9. That's a tremendous successful story. Hope it's boosting their income enough for them to undertake all of the development work that they're doing as well in terms of the Falcon Heavy and the BFR. Now, last month we talked about the Falcon Heavy launching the Tesla Roadster car and the mannequin within it, but they've now got a paying passenger, the first paying customer, I should say, for the Falcon Heavy. And that will be launched in June. And the person paying for it is the Department of Defense. The United States Air Force will be launching several satellites on that Falcon Heavy. It won't only be the US Air Force. There's going to be 25 satellites in total launched, most of them from the USAF. Others are going to be from NASA and other research institutions. However, those satellites, the 25, some of those are actually going to deploy other satellites, sub-satellites, once they're safely in orbit themselves. So those will probably be CubeSats. So I can't tell you the total number of satellites that Falcon Heavy is taking up. Now, I mentioned the BFR. We know that the B stands for big and the R stands for rocket. We can only guess what the F stands for, but that is now under construction as a prototype rocket. And earlier this month, Elon Musk, the CEO, announced that by next June of next year, 2019, it will have start to undertake atmospheric tests. He hasn't explained, at least not that I've seen, what that means. I can only take it to mean that it will be similar to some of the tests that earlier Falcon rockets went through. That is, launching vertically, you know, from a standard launch pad, hovering briefly, and then reversing and coming back down under control. Because that's an important thing to get right. One of the big attractions of the BFR, well, amongst its throw weight and its launch capability and huge size, is its ability to be reusable. And landing vertically and being able to be refurbished is an essential part of that. Now, that's a monstrous rocket. So it's one thing to get a relatively lightweight rocket to land vertically, and only SpaceX have been doing that with rockets that they've taken into orbit, but they need to gross that up now to be able to do it with the BFR. So it's going to be interesting to watch how that progresses. Now, whilst we're talking about spacecraft, of course, many spacecraft have been to Jupiter. We've got the Juno mission there at the moment. And that has contributed to a recent study, together with other missions, looking at the red spot. Now, Jupiter's red spot is something that some of our listeners might have seen. Certainly many of them will have turned binoculars or telescopes onto Jupiter and seen its disk and its four Galilean satellites. But those with telescopes will have seen the equatorial bands, dark bands, cloud bands around the surface of either side of the equator on the surface of Jupiter. Embedded within those bands is the Great Red Spot. Now, we know that even people of Galileo's sort of time had observed a red spot on the surface of Jupiter going way, way back then. But we don't know whether that's the same red spot that they saw that we've been observing. It might have been another one, because there are storms that are short-lived. Others, like this red spot, is long-lived. We've known that this big red spot has been there since at least the 1830s. But over time, it's changed, and there have been continuous measurements of its size since as far long ago as 1878. People have been measuring how big it was. And, you know, our storms change shape and are obviously much shorter duration. But this is a huge anticyclone. Originally, it was as big as about 3 Earth diameters. It was huge. Now, it's just about a little bit bigger than 1 Earth diameter. Now, it's still a massive storm to be that big, but it is shrinking. But so why? It's also been changing colour. Even in the time I've been watching it, I've seen that it's changed its colour a little bit. I don't see it as red anymore. Maybe it's my eyes, but I see it as a sort of greyish, pinkish, orange sort of colour. But they found that the reason that it's apparently shrinking is it's actually growing taller. What was an amorphous blob has been stretched, and from our perspective, looking down on it, as it's got stretched and become taller, naturally it's become thinner. So that seems to be the explanation. Now, Juno itself has also been studying these cloud bands. It's been using infrared instruments to get beneath the cloud surface. And it was thought originally that these clouds were relatively thin, these equatorial bands were relatively thin, maybe something like our jet stream at the top of the atmosphere. Not so. It's been found that these clouds go down to a depth of about 1,900 miles, much, much further than anybody had thought before. And they rotate as one. The cloud band will rotate at one speed compared to the bands that are between, which seem to be going backwards, the other parts of the atmosphere, in comparison to the speed with which that band goes down. Goes round. And they've also discovered that below that 2,000 or so mile limit, then the rest of Jupiter seems to be rotating as if it was one solid body. We know that it's gas, but it's gas under extreme pressure, acting as if it was a solid. So the more we can get spacecraft around these planets, like the Juno mission, the more we're learning. It really is an incredible time in terms of discoveries at the moment. Now, there has been some concerns about whether Britain might, as a result of Brexit, be excluded from some of these missions. So some good news and, you know, some troubling news. You know, in the paper recently, the European Commission has been saying that because of Brexit, there's no guarantee that we can continue in projects like Galileo. Now, that's the replacement set of satellites for the American GPS. Well, it's not replacement for, it's just geared for European needs, and it will be civilian run rather than militarily run, as is GPS. Now that's going to go live within the next year or so. It's under test at the moment, and Britain was going to be a big user of that, and also of the Copernicus satellite, which is a really high-tech new meteorological and earth environment satellite. And they're saying there's no guarantee that we'll be getting the data from that, even though we've had a heck of an involvement up until now. I hope that these are just bargaining chips by the European Commission, and that we will. Some of our universities have been trying to Brexit-proof themselves by establishing hard concrete arrangements with research establishments within Europe. So hopefully we'll get there. But one bit of good news, we are quite separately a member of the European Space Agency. That's not part of the EU. So our membership of that is safe and will continue. And the European Space Agency has just awarded the next science mission to a British-led team. And that's going to be one set up to study the atmospheres of exoplanets. You know, we've discovered around other stars something like 4,000 planets so far, or are candidates to be confirmed as exoplanets. All of these things, of course, are long term. So the launch date for that, if it gets final approval in 2020, wouldn't be until 2028. But we have preliminary approval. it's been selected. The mission is called Ariel, which is actually the reuse of a name of a satellite. Britain had a series of Ariel satellites back in the 60s, but launched by NASA for us. And this one, ARIEL, stands for Atmospheric Remote Sensing Infrared Exoplanet Large Survey. Which doesn't exactly stick in the memory, but Ariel perhaps does. Now, this won't be in Earth orbit. It'll be placed at what's called the second Lagrange point. Now, these are, if you like, parking places in space. It's some areas, there's five of them, where all the forces balance out. That's the centrifugal force that a spacecraft would experience as it's whizzing around the sun, balanced against the sun's gravity, the Earth's gravity, and also that of the moon. So where you get an equilibrium sort of point, it means that spacecraft can sit there and stay there with using very little fuel, just a little bit of fuel usage to maintain station and pointing and so on. So this aerial will be set up in the second of these Lagrange points. And its mission is not to discover new exoplanets, but to peer deeply into the atmosphere of about 1,000 exoplanets that are already confirmed, ones that have been discovered by the Kepler mission and others that might be discovered by a new mission with a similar objective called TESS, which will be launched fairly soon. So that's going to be quite an exciting mission. Now, whilst we're talking about putting spacecraft into orbit, of course, it does bring into our thoughts, well, what goes up must come down. And that has happened in the past. Things like the American Space Lab came down. And as it's huge, it survived re-entry. Smaller satellites get burnt up. But most of Space Lab burnt up, but some chunks did land in the Australian outback and now displayed in the nearest pub and so on. That's going to happen again this weekend. And not to an American space station, but to the Chinese one, Tiangong 1, Heavenly Palace. That's going to enter the atmosphere somewhere between the morning of the 31st of March and the afternoon of the 1st of March. It's really uncertain. They'll narrow that window of uncertainty, that cone of uncertainty, as time gets closer. So it's completely impossible to predict where it's going to land. All that we know is that it will disintegrate somewhere between the northern and southern limits of its tilted orbit, and that's at 42.8 degrees north and 42.8 degrees south. However, although that means we're safe because we're above that, it does mean that the vast majority of the world's population is within that area. However, what the saving grace is, most of the world is actually water, sea, rather than land. So the chances are, well, most of it will burn up. The few bits that survive will come down, but they'll come down somewhere over the sea. And somebody has calculated the chances of being hit, even by people in those areas, as being 10 million times less than the chance of being hit by a lightning strike. So we can all rest fairly easily in our beds. But it was going to make a fantastic image if anybody's in the parts where it comes down, because it will be quite a spectacular fireball. Few bits of brief news for you, Dave. We talked in the past, I'm sure you remember, talking about messenger that's first to arrive that comes from afar. That's the English translation of Oumuamua, the Hawaiian name given to the first international asteroid ever discovered. Now, scientists were surprised by that because they expected any interstellar visitors to be comets. And here this thing turned up, it's a rocky asteroid. So they've looked again at how objects like that could be ejected. And they found that binary star systems, which is a huge percentage of star systems are actually binaries, the binary systems are quite likely to eject asteroids. Each of the stars in the system would have an asteroid belt, and those things would interact. The gravitational fields of all of those two stars will interact and will cause an asteroid to speed up and get chucked out. So they now believe that rocky bodies such as Oumuamua are likely to be as common as comets wandering about between stars and eventually falling into another solar system, as that one did. Now, not quite so far away, but at the far edge of our solar system, we have a spacecraft, New Horizons, that went past Pluto, which used to be a planet, of course, but was downgraded to a dwarf planet. That orbits in something we called the Kuiper Belt. Now, those are remnants of the solar system, things that didn't get formed into planets, the dust and ice left over from when the solar system first formed. Now, it's New Horizons, as it's still working, has been targeted to slightly tweak its trajectory so that it passes by one of these Kuiper Belt objects. And the one that's been selected is called 2014 MU69. It doesn't trip off the tongue, so they thought a nickname was needed. So they've borrowed on a name from a mythical distant island that medieval map makers used to put on their maps, called Thule. And so they've called it Ultima Thule. Now, that tiny little world, it's about the size of a city, but it will get a name when New Horizons gets to it and starts taking images, and that's going to occur on the 1st of January next year. So we'll report on that when we start seeing the images. That's 4 billion miles away that those images will come back from, because at the moment it's so small and so far, we don't know whether it's one object, or is it made up of two chunks, or is it three, because the various observations that have been made so far just can't quite determine its size or shape. Last bit of news for you, Dave, a bit of a sorry story, but it's about Hubble's replacement, and that's called the James Webb Telescope, and it's going to be tremendous. It suffered from yet another launch delay, I'm afraid, now likely to be no earlier than May 2020. But let me just tell you a little bit about it. Hubble, which has been tremendously successful, had a mirror on it of 2.5 meters in diameter. That's big, way, way bigger than my telescope. But this James Webb telescope is going to be even bigger, nearly three times as big, 6.7 meters and weighing 13,000 pounds. Now, there isn't a spacecraft with that sort of diameter to launch something like that in one go. So what's going to happen is it'll be launched with its mirror furled in several segments making up the mirror. Once it gets into space, then those segments will unfurl like the petals of a flower and form a mirror shape. So that means that we've got to make sure that all of those components making up that James Webb telescope work. So all of the parts have been constructed, but it's just taking longer to get it right, to get it all assembled and get it tested. Now, Hubble had the advantage of being in low Earth orbit, so when something went wrong, and it did, they were able to send up the space shuttle and give it a pair of spectacles, effectively, to get the focus right of the telescope. We can't do that with the James Webb telescope. It's not going to be in Earth orbit. It's going to be in one of these Lagrange points that I mentioned a little bit earlier, a million miles away. Now, we're not going to get a spacecraft, a manned spacecraft there to fix it. So it's got to be right, especially when you think of the cost. It was originally expected to be $1.6 billion. It's now gone up to about $8 billion. You've got one chance to launch it, one chance to get it right. You've got to make sure. So that's it, Dave. That's my report on things that I've found of interest over the last month and hope that the listeners find them of interest too.
Thank you, John, for the update.
Stars Over Surrey with Dave Jemetis and John Axtell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
So what's your constellation of the month then, John?
My constellation of the month, Dave, is one that I guess a lot of people won't have seen. Many people will be familiar with the larger, brighter constellations like Orion or the Plough, or my constellation of the month for last month, which was Gemini. And this one is called Cancer. But it's not that well known because it's made up of faint stars rather than the brighter stars that we see in the constellations I've just mentioned. But it's still an interesting constellation. It contains some interesting double stars, even a triple star, and some interesting star clusters, one of which can even be seen by the naked eye if you know exactly where to look. So I'll be talking about that on the usual video that we'll make available through the website.
Thank you, John.
Stars Over Surrey, the monthly guide to the night sky.
Now, John, what will our listeners be able to see in the night sky over the next month?
Okay, Dave, well, the most easily identifiable constellation is probably Orion. That's still with us, but it's now down in the west by the time, you know, we start to look in mid to late evening. Gemini, my constellation of the month last year, is good, and other constellations coming up that people will recognise. The Plough, that's more or less overhead. Leo would be some way below that. That's a nice, easy constellation to find, and if Leo is there, then the amateur astronomers amongst our listeners will know that that means it's galaxy time, because next to Leo is Virgo, and between Virgo and Leo there are hosts of galaxies to be found, some of which can be seen with relatively small telescopes. Another constellation that's coming up will be Bootis, which is, if my memory serves me right, was the very first constellation of the when we started this series. So some good constellations to be seen in the night sky. Let's have a think about the moon. Best time for looking at the moon would be the 22nd of the month, or a few days either side of that. So that's when it's at first quarter, or earlier in the month, if you don't mind getting up early in the morning, at the 7th of the month, that's when it's in third quarter. A different half moon facing the sun, if you like. For complete darkness, a completely dark sky, without any light pollution from the moon, that would be when the new moon occurs on the 15th of the month, and full moon the 29th. No blue moon for you this month, David, I'm afraid. Okay, now let's think about the planets. Mercury was good last month, and I was very pleased to take a picture of that with Venus and the moon, but Mercury has now gone. Venus is still there. A brilliant object, really so bright, magnitude minus 3.8. That's brighter than anything else in the night sky by a long mile. But that would be low in the west-northwest. And by the end of the month, it'll be setting 3 hours after the sun, so plenty of time to turn your telescopes onto Venus, or just see it with the naked eye. Makes a nice sight, particularly when it's a long alongside the moon, which it will be. I can't remember the date, but I'll tell you in just a short while. Mars, Next planet out from Earth is there and is brightening as the month draws on, but very, you know, compared to Venus, nowhere near as bright as that, from magnitude around magnitude zero. Still brighter than many of the stars nearby, but that's a morning object, visible in the southeast from about mid-morning. By mid-morning, I mean 3:30 a.m., but, you know, before sunrise. Jupiter is another morning object, and again, this one is very bright, minus 2.2 magnitude, in the south, easily visible in the early hours. So visible through the whole of the night, in the sense that it starts to rise now this month before midnight. So from then on, you should easily be able to find it. Saturn is another one of these early morning planets. It's such a shame that to see the planets you have to get up early, but that's the way of astronomy, I'm afraid. A dimmer object because of its distance, magnitude 0.9, but getting better as the month progresses, low in the southeastern sky. Uranus, to all intents and purposes, not visible this month, and same for Neptune. Now, you can see some of these planets close together, which makes for an interesting sight. So on the 2nd of April, Mars and Saturn are just over a degree apart, and the sight will be made even more interesting because Mars will only be a third of a moon's width above a nice globular cluster called M22, down in the Sagittarius part of the sky. So you'll get that wonderful globular cluster very close to Mars, and then less than three moons' widths away from that, you'll have Saturn. But again, it does mean getting up about 4 o'clock in the morning. Make a nice picture if you can get that group together in a good, strong telephoto lens or a camera attached to a telescope. Even, you know, don't think you have to have special, well, you do have to have special attachments, but if you don't have that, you could even try an iPhone against a spotting telescope, something like that. But it's not so easy to hold an iPhone to a telescope and get a good image, but it can be done with perseverance, or you can buy little clamps that would hold an iPhone to a telescope. Well worth doing. I've tried it successfully several times. A little bit later on, in fact, just a couple of days, on either the 3rd or the 4th, again in the dawn, but the moon will be close to Jupiter. One side of Jupiter on the 3rd, the other side of Jupiter on the 4th. Again, make quite a nice sight. And then you've got a very nice grouping of the moon with Mars and Saturn, low in the southeast, shortly before sunrise on the 7th and 8th. So if you get some clear skies around that first week in April, and you like seeing groupings of planets, as I do, well worth setting that alarm. Another grouping of the moon will be with Venus, and that, this one shortly, fortunately rather, will be in the evening. So shortly after sunset on the 17th in the west, look for the moon, and 6 degrees away there'll be the bright Venus. And Venus is so bright and the moon is bright, that'll make quite an easy photograph and quite an effective one. We have got a meteor shower this month, and that's the Lyrids meteor shower. And that's on the... well, midday on the 22nd. So that's when the maximum theoretically occurs. So in other words, look for these meteors on the evening of the 21st and after midnight on the morning of the 22nd, but still the evening of the 22nd. It's still worth having a look. Now, the theoretical max of this particular shower, the Lyrids, is only 18 per hour, and that's under all perfect conditions. In reality, it's likely to be about a third of that. But worth trying. Another interesting sight, and that could make a good view through binoculars and another camera-worthy event, is on the 24th. And that's when Venus is only a few degrees, 4 degrees, below the Pleiades, which is a really nice little cluster within Taurus, the bull. Many people will know the Pleiades, the Seven Sisters, or M45 in the Messier catalogue. Now, some meetings at local societies on Thursday the 5th, 7:30, at the University of Surrey. Guildford Astronomical Society are hosting Professor David Waltham. He's from the Department of Earth Sciences at Royal Holloway, not that far away, part of the University of London. And his topic is going to be Lucky Planet. Circumstances are, with the kind of moon that we've got and the kind of distance from the sun that we are, life has been evolving, as we know, because we're part of it. But are we the only ones? Are there other planets that have that kind of circumstance that we do? That's the thrust of his lecture, as I understand it. Farnham Astronomical Society, who meet at the Aldershot Cricket Club, have a meeting on the Tuesday the 10th of April with Dr. Dida Markovic from the Institute of Cosmology and Gravitation at the University of Portsmouth, and his the title is Euclid and the Dark Universe. Going a little further afield, Croydon Astronomical Society, who meet at Royal Russell School in Croydon, two talks, both by their own members, I believe, Cepheid Variables and Magnetism. That's on Friday the 13th of April by Conrad Mallin-Smith and Roy Easto. And on Friday the 27th, a fortnight later, but still at Royal Russell, Paul Coleman will be talking about the solar eclipse of 2017 in the USA. The one I attended, no doubt he'll be showing his images and perhaps videos and his experiences of the event. Ewell Astronomical Society meet at another school in their field. It's Nonsuch High School for Girls at Cheam. And their meeting is on Friday the 13th, and I think it's one of their members, David Fishwick. He'll be talking about 13 journeys through space and time. And if you're more of an armchair astronomer, as we all are at times, doing some astronomy by night, sitting in the armchair watching the BBC Sky at night, the programme is Sunday the 8th of April and repeated on the 12th of April, both on BBC 4. And the title is Mars, Red and Dead. So the question mark. So the team is going to talk about the latest results from NASA's Curiosity mission and also the European Space Agency's ExoMars mission, the part called Trace Gas Orbiter, which is looking for, well, effectively methane concentrations within the atmosphere of Mars or on the surface. So methane would be a sign of life. Maggie Adarin Pocock will be looking at how the next lander heading to Mars, that's the InSight mission that I talked about last month with my ticket on it. So she'll be talking how that was going to be surviving its hostile environment. That's going to be landing near the equator of Mars and in an area, you know, subject to sandstorms, things of that ilk. Chris will be talking to Andy Weir, who is the author of the book and the science fiction film The Martian, where, you know, a man managed to live on Mars for the best part of a year by growing potatoes in the soil and so on, when he'd been abandoned, thought dead, and survived and was rescued. So that'll be interesting. So that's Chris Lintock, will be talking to him. So that's about it. I haven't got any outreach events, any observing events to tell you about. The university's last one was in March. They'll be starting their series of events again in October. There you go, Dave. That's my look at the night sky.
Thank you, John, for the fascinating insight. The next edition of Stars Over Surrey will be Friday, 27th of April.
Stars Over Surrey with Dave Jamatis and John Axtell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, why not keep up to date with The Sound of Surrey by listening live at brooklandsradio.co.uk or through our free mobile app.